This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's been a lot of bad economic news of late. Inflation is up, so are foreclosures and unemployment. Gas and oil prices are high, and some say going higher. The dollar is down. Economic growth is sluggish at best, and not surprisingly, consumer confidence numbers are low. Though President Bush said again today he doesn't think we're going to go into a recession, plenty of economists disagree with him, and the combination of rising inflation and little or no growth has revived a term last used 30 years ago, stagflation. Amid all the questions and concerns, a lot of people are reconsidering their options. So in the current economic climate, are you looking at your assets differently? Or if you're changing your medium or long-range plans, not to remodel, for example, or send your kid to public rather than private school, or postpone that new car? And what are your questions about stagflation? Our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you can tell us your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, David Gardner of The Motley Fool will join us to answer your questions about investments and the stock market and to talk a little bit about my fantasy portfolio. But first, economic plan Bs. We begin with Dean Baker, an economist and co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Good of you to come in today.
Thanks for having me on.
And stagflation. Well, what is it exactly?
Well, the basic story is it's a mix of both inflation and slow growth. We usually think these are opposites. So, you know, we're used to having periods in which there's high unemployment, slow growth, and typically we think during those times inflation is low. We might even have a problem with deflation, as we were worried about back about 5 or 6 years ago. Conversely, when inflation is high, that's usually a time when we think that unemployment is low, the economy is growing rapidly. So to see the two together, stagflation, where we have both inflation and slow growth, rising unemployment, that's unusual. That was a story we had back in the 70s, driven primarily by higher oil prices, but also we had higher agricultural prices, then too a falling dollar. Then we did have this combination of inflation and unemployment. But usually that's not the way it is. And the big problem with stagflation is you don't know which one to hit. You know, if we simply had high unemployment, we have an easy story we could tell. We simply try and stimulate the economy. We have a stimulus package like Congress just passed. We have the Fed lower interest rates. That's an easy story to tell. Conversely, if we want to fight inflation, we know how to do that. We try to tighten up. You know, we try to get down a budget deficit. We have the Federal Reserve Board raise interest rates. Those are the standard recipes. But that can't work when we're trying to combat both high inflation and slow growth at the same time.
Yeah, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said today in front of Congress, you know, yes, we've got to get growth going, but this inflation really complicates our lives. But that combination, you mentioned high oil prices, well, oil over $100 a barrel of late, wheat prices and other food commodities are going through the roof, and unemployment is up too. Is this a recipe for stagflation on the same scale as we had in the 70s?
Well, I think it's a different story. I mean, we are seeing both higher inflation and, you know, I think we are going to see a very severe recession. I think we're at the beginnings of that. It's a different story than what we had in the 70s, though. In the 70s, we had a very different economy than we had today. Most importantly, we had a much more unionized economy. That had the plus and minus. The plus was that workers had some protection against inflation. You know, they had union that could get higher wages when they saw higher prices. But the minus was that gave us a wage price spiral. So we saw inflation continue to ratchet up through the 70s. Today, we have a much less unionized economy. The contracts we used to have back in the 70s where wages were often indexed formally to the Consumer Price Index, those are almost invisible now.
Everybody remembers the old COLA, cost of living adjustment.
Yeah, not many, my place we have COLAs, but not many other places where you find the cost of living adjustment. It's very, very rare in the public or private sector these days. So we aren't going to see a wage price spiral like that. We also have a much more globalized economy. So back in the 70s, we were considerably more insular. If you look at the non-oil portion of our trade is about twice as large relative to the economy as what it was back in the 70s. So that means that, you know, we can't just pass on higher wages and higher prices. It's a very, very different world. On the other hand, the flip side of that, one of the causes of inflation right now is the falling dollar. We're paying a lot more for our imports, and I expect that to continue. So that will be, you know, probably the main cause of inflation in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. And similarly, going back to the 70s, how did we get out of it then, and does that bear lessons for our situation now?
Well, yeah, how we got out of it was not a pretty story. We had the worst recession in the post-war period. You might recall Paul Volcker came in as head of the Federal Reserve Board at the end of 1979. Probably Jimmy Carter, at least in his view, had gathered his biggest mistake because he threw the economy into a recession. I mean, not deliberately, but he raised interest rates, and he raised them enough to throw the economy in a recession in 1980 as Jimmy Carter was running for re-election. And then he pulled back on that, and, you know, then we had 1981. He again tightened up on interest rates. Economy went into a recession, and unemployment went through the roof, eventually hit 11% at its peak in 1982. So it was a very long, very steep recession. We didn't get the unemployment rate back down to the pre-1980 levels till the end of that decade. So hopefully we're not looking at something like that now.
Our guest is Dean Baker, an economist and co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Roger. Roger calling us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hey, good afternoon. How you doing?
Okay.
Hey, I guess I was just trying to think of what are the prime factors as to why we're in this economic problem that we're in right now. I mean, obviously, housing market keeps getting thrown up, but I mean, what else is triggering this? Because I'm just kind of curious, you know, 10, 20 years from now, are we going to be looking at something similar like this? We're kind of like in a perfect storm economically right now for everything kind of pointing downward.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the housing market really does sit front and center here. And I think we had incredible negligence on the part of policymakers. I mean, I put Alan Greenspan here front and center, but there are a lot of other people that share some of this blame. The housing bubble was growing, you know, beyond leaps and bounds, beyond anything that made sense. And this isn't 2020 hindsight, by the way. I've been talking about this for a number of years. I mean, house prices were nearly just track inflation. In the last decade, they outpaced inflation by about 70%. That created $8 trillion in housing bubble wealth. What we're seeing now is the collapse of that bubble. House prices are falling at a double-digit rate. Construction is down by 50%. Sales are down by 40%. That's what's throwing the economy into the recession. The other part of the story, the inflation part, is we had an overvalued dollar. You know, in the late 90s, Robert Rubin, Bill Clinton thought it was a very good idea to have a high dollar in the short term. That's nice in some ways. It means we can get cheap imports. But that couldn't be sustained. We got a trade deficit that was over $800 billion a couple years ago, 6% of GDP. You simply can't sustain that. You could have that for a year, 2 years, 3 years, but it was unsustainable over long term. It was inevitable that the dollar would fall, and that's what we're seeing now. And unfortunately, we're seeing the two together, the collapse of the housing bubble pushing the economy into a recession at the same time that the dollar's falling, you know, quite precipitously against some currency, leading to higher prices and higher import prices and inflation. So it was really bad policy that got us here.
Roger, thanks for the call.
Oh, thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Ginny in Colorado. I'd like to hear somebody address what rate of growth is better for sustainability and overall containment of overconsumption. Spending isn't the answer to everything. Perhaps a slower economy would be better for the planet.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, I take very seriously how we, you know, how we have to respect the planet, and, you know, we do have to do something to contain greenhouse gas emissions. We've been incredibly negligent on that. I don't think slow growth is going to be the answer, though. I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to have to do things like have more fuel-efficient cars. We can drive less. I mean, it'd be great if we got people in situations where they didn't have to drive as much, if they could rely more on public transit, if, you know, maybe they didn't have to commute to work as far or as frequently. But that's, I think, actually done much better in a growing economy. And growing does not mean consuming more in the sense of buying more goods or bigger cars. It can mean, you know, that we go to more lectures or, you know, have better computers that we could, you know, download things from all over the world. It doesn't mean using more resources. So we absolutely have to take seriously the fact that, you know, we have been doing great harm to the planet and try and reduce that. But I don't think slow growth is the way to get there.
We're talking with Dean Baker, an economist, and we're asking listeners, what about their plan Bs? We're particularly talking about assets as you look ahead towards your plans for the medium and longer term. Are you changing your decision-making about sending a kid to public rather than to private school, postponing that new car maybe? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's go to Jeannie. Jeannie's with us from Georgia.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was just wondering, I'm 40, my husband's 48, we've been married 10 years and have no children, have no intention of having them. While everyone else was spending their money like crazy, we saved and scrimped and paid on our house and paid on our student loans, and now we thought we were in a position to finally spend some money, and then this economy happens. I guess what I'm wanting to know is, should we buckle down or can we buy some furniture and TVs and such?
Well, that's a good question. I'm reluctant to speak to anyone's specific situation. I guess what I'd just say is, be cautious. If your house price had gone through the roof over the last decade, and Georgia was one of the less affected areas, I wouldn't say there was no bubble there, but it was, certainly not like Florida or Southern California or some of the other areas, including D.C., that had prices in some cases triple. But if your house price did not go through the roof, it probably won't go through the floor. So, what I do is take a look at how much equity you have in your home, recognize that house price can fall a little bit, even if it didn't go up 100%. If it went up 40 or 50%, maybe it'll fall back 10%. That can happen. But if you'd be comfortable with that, and then you'd still be able to, afford the TV or whatever it is that, you have on your shopping list, no reason not to do it. We only live so long, so I'm not going to tell everyone to be, save forever, but I'd urge you to be cautious.
Even
so, thank you very much for the call, Jeannie. But people in her situation, if you're advising them to be cautious, that spurt of consumer spending that might get their economy going again, you're suggesting this might not be the right time to expect that.
Well, that's right. I mean, that was part of the problem. When you look to trying to stimulate the economy, we're looking for different routes, and, Congress went one route with the tax rebate, and some of that money will be spent. I mean, in many cases, you have people literally living at the edge, so you give them a check of $500, they're going to spend it. They have no choice. They need to do it to, put the food on the table or whatever it might be. But a lot of other people are going to make a decision that, they see their house prices just plummeted, and their stocks might have fallen as well, and they will save it. So, that's why some of us were advocating some other routes. You could have given money to state and local governments so they don't have to make cutbacks that many of them are making. You could have spent some on infrastructure. You could have done a green tax credit. That was a proposal one of the other callers a moment ago was saying, can we reduce the harm we're doing to the planet? Well, suppose we had given a tax credit for people to install energy-efficient windows, increase the insulation in their home, a use it or lose it tax credit. You have 1 year to do that. I think there are better ways to try and stimulate the economy than what Congress ended up doing. It was better than nothing, but it wouldn't have been my preferred course.
Dean Baker, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it. Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. He joined us here in Studio 3A. If you're taking a look at your assets in this fragile economy, maybe you're reappraising that Renoir, or heaven forfend, even thinking about putting your comic books on eBay. We'll have some answers for you. A Plan B next. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We've just learned a little bit about a particularly buzzy economic term, stagflation. If you want to learn even more about the history of that term and find out why one economist thinks it's being misused today, you can go to our website at npr.org/talk. Right now, we're taking a tour through the coffers of America. If you're eyeing your assets and dreaming up a Plan B, thinking about selling your house, your second car, your Stradivarius, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can read what other listeners have to say at our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Joining us now from her home in Maryland is Michelle Singletary, financial correspondent for The Washington Post and personal finance contributor for NPR's Day Today. And Michelle, nice to have you on the program today.
Hey, good. Good to be here.
And typically, I guess people's houses are the first thing you think of as their assets. But what else would qualify under that term?
Well, the assets that have the chance of appreciating would include, any retirement accounts you have, stocks, bonds, CDs, money you've got in mutual funds, all those kinds of things. Now, you can count your car as an asset, but generally speaking, most people or a lot of people are upside down on their cars, meaning they owe more than the car is worth. So many people can't sell their cars that raise any money these days. So you want to look to those things that have an appreciative value, like your home and all the things that I just listed.
And we're going to talk specifically about stocks later in the program with the Motley Fool. Mm-hmm. But there is also people who have collectibles, and there's other ways to ratchet down your spending. Again, adjusting long-term plans. Put off that decision to remodel, not buy the new car. Send your kid to public school, maybe a public university, rather than a private one.
That's right. And I like the last part when you talked about school. Think further out of the box. Listen, you can send your kid to a community college for 2 years, get all those mandatory courses out of the way, then send them to the four-year university for half the cost. And that's a great way to save on college costs. I mean, when it's times like this, I actually, you know, everybody's panicking, but I like these times because it gives people time to pause and think and be scared. And you should be scared. If you're doing well, look at this time to take inventory of what you were doing right and continue to do it and even more. And if you've been trifling and you haven't done what you need to do, use this time to step back and develop a plan B if you didn't have one already.
Let's see if we can get a caller in on this conversation and go to Kevin. Kevin's with us from North Carolina.
Hi.
Hi, Kevin.
How are you?
Hi, Kevin.
Well, my comment is because of the way the economy is, I've had to put off buying a new car. I had about $15,000 I wanted to put into a new car, but it's turning out that my income is going down because I have a store where I sell cell phone accessories, and there's not enough sales. People aren't buying. They're buying only what they absolutely have to have and not what they really want. So instead of buying a new car, I just fixed up my old used car and, you know, put a little money into that and decided I'm going to have to drive that for a few years until I can, you know, make more money and afford to buy a new car.
And
that's a great strategy, Kevin. Now, how old is your old car that you're talking about?
It's a 96.
And how many miles?
That's like 150,000 miles.
Okay, so that's getting up there. That's getting up there. Listen, I tell people, keep your car until they push you off the road. And you know, Kevin, with $15,000, you could take half of that and still buy a car that's much newer if you had to. I mean, you didn't have to spend all of that money. You can buy a really nice used car for, you know, $6,000 or $7,000, and it'd be in great shape because there are a lot of knuckleheads out there who lease cars, had to turn them in, and they're in great shape. So if by chance that clunker doesn't make it, I call it hoopties, you could still get a car and still have that money saved up for your emergency until your store starts to get back some of those sales that you had.
Kevin, good luck to you, and we'll be looking out for you on the road.
All right, thank you.
Make sure you got AAA or something, you know.
Let's see if we can go now to Michael. Michael with us from Tulsa in Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going?
Sure.
Well, what I was calling is my wife and I are in our mid-40s. About $80,000 a year, solid middle class, and no kids. And we have, we're refinancing our house to get a lower mortgage payment. I'm actually at my bank's parking lot right now going in to sign the papers.
Mm-hmm.
we're going to put off some home remodeling that we were going to do. And my wife was seriously thinking about taking a 2-year leave of absence, going back to college to get her master's, and now we're reconsidering that decision, mm-hmm. maybe waiting a year or so and seeing if things improve. We're in good shape, but we're a little worried about the future. You know, it's like we got some cash reserves. And as far as investments, we both have 401Ks. We've got about $120,000 in them, and we've gone a little more conservative with them, and we don't really worry too much about that. Mm-hmm. Figure if the market goes down, we just get to buy more, and eventually it'll go back up.
Right. Mike, let me ask you this. You said you have a little bit of cash reserve. How much?
Probably about $10,000.
So, and that would cover about how long? If you lost your job, I think you said your wife was working.
It'd be good for about 6 months if one of us lost our job with $10,000.
Oh, so that's good. So you're really, really good. Now, how are you going to pay for that school when she goes back?
Well, we're going to... Basically.
Don't say borrow. Mike, don't say borrow. I will have to jump through this line. Don't say borrow.
Well, no, it's we were going to start using the cash reserve. We're at a point where we could pretty much pay for it over about 2-year period. We're planning ahead.
From your cash reserve?
One of the reasons we're doing our cost cutting, refinancing for a lower mortgage. Both our cars are in pretty good shape.
Okay, wait, hold up.
I got rid of my cable television and switched to DirecTV because it was $50 a month cheaper.
Okay, but how are you going to pay? Now, you said you've got the cash reserve. You're not going to touch that to pay for it.
We're going to tighten up, basically. We're going to do a lot of tightening up.
Okay.
We're not going to take any vacations.
Good for you.
And that sort of thing. And
Michael will choose to believe you rather than Congress when they say they're going to cut spending. So.
Well, that's something else, too. The tax rebate, the stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are in pretty good shape financially. A lot of our friends are about the same age class as us. Most of us, and we've been talking about this at parties and things, when we get that check, we're going to pay bills with it.
Good for you.
Spend it. Well, they want you to spend it, but we're not going to. We're going to send it to MasterCard.
Now, you said you have bills. How much do you have in bills? Now, see how you talk to people, supposed to start coming out. How much credit card debt do you have?
We've got about $7,000 or $8,000, and I should have it paid off in about 9 months.
Oh, wonderful.
We used a lot of it for home remodeling.
Oh, okay. Yeah, now what I want you to do going forward, you are doing great, and you are in a
great Our total mortgage is only two-thirds of our yearly gross income.
Well, basically, you want to keep it, I look at it on a monthly basis, you want to keep your mortgage anywhere from 28 to 35% of your net
15%
monthly income.
Right now.
So that's wonderful. Get rid of that credit card debt. You're absolutely right. And going forward, Mike, your plan B is to never borrow again if you don't have to.
Michael, good luck.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from Eleanor in Topeka, Kansas. I'm 79 years old, live primarily on Social Security with a small income from freelance editing and writing. It's been tight but workable until recently. Now prices are going sky high. Where do I find a plan B?
You know, that's tough because how else can you, you know, get more income? I would ask her to see if there's some way that perhaps she could rent out a room or take in a roommate. Now, I know some people out there throwing, what are you talking about? She's 79. But when things get tight and she can't, I mean, I would hope that she doesn't have to take another job, to certainly think of some ways to generate some more income. And that's one way. You know, if she's in an area where there's lots of families with little kids, maybe she can volunteer, not volunteer, but, you know, do some babysitting for some families. I would love to hire a grandmother to watch my three Rugrats. So you got to think outside of the box when you're in that kind of position.
Let's go now to Bill. Bill with us from Shelton in Connecticut.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. I've been a long-time listener for your show, and I enjoy it.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for doing it. And welcome to your guest.
Thank you very much.
I've been listening to your comments and things, and very interesting. I live in southern Connecticut. Up around the Fairfield County area.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years ago, I purchased a house. I'm a carpenter contractor. And I purchased a house, totally renovated it, took it down to the studs, okay, and reinstalled everything and everything, you know, redid the whole house over. And so now I'm kind of sitting on it, okay. So you were talking about Plan B a little while ago. What I had thought of doing and would like some advice from you guys on, is since the New England market didn't bubble as much as the Midwest and the West Coast, we're all kind of holding on to our prices.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my house on the market now since August of last year, and I really only dropped my price a little bit. But we seem to be holding our, you know, we're not dropping our prices up here.
So what's the question? What should you sell, rent? Are you renting it right now?
What I'm wanting to do is to rent it out or to rent it to a nonprofit organization like Homefront or a battered women's shelter or something like that while I wait out the market.
Right. I mean, if you can rent it and it can pay for the mortgage, I assume you have a mortgage on it.
Yes, I do.
And it can comfortably pay, sure, that's definitely an option. I mean, no one can tell what the market is going to do, and anybody who says that is a liar. So if you feel as if you can eke out some more and you can get a renter in there to cover the mortgage, that's certainly a great Plan B strategy. Or if you're really crunched in your other, you know, resources and you do need to sell, you may not get as much as you thought because, you know, lots of prices were inflated. So, you know, it's not settling, but it's being realistic about what you can get for that home.
Interestingly, we got an email along these same lines, though, from the other coast, from Matt in Lancaster, California. My wife and I bought 5 houses this year. We're remodeling to rent. These houses were foreclosed properties and were all extremely cheap. How additionally, we're refinancing our own home and the rates seem to be very favorable.
Right. Yeah. I can understand that, but, you know, for myself, I would do one at a time.
I agree with him. You know, listen, this is what got us into the housing mess.
You know.
People bought all these properties, and they couldn't carry the mortgages. If that family in California has enough in savings to carry those while they're renovating and trying to get renters, fine. But if not, get rid of them.
Right, right. Well, I know you have an upcoming segment that you just mentioned before that you picked up on my line, and that I also have a portfolio.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Balance the two.
Yeah, we'll talk about that with the Motley Fool in just a few minutes. But anyway.
Which I'm looking forward to hearing.
Good. Stay with us, Bill. Appreciate it. Here's an email we have from Allison in Idaho. My husband and I moved to Idaho in order to raise our son near my extended family. We thought my husband could commute to his out-of-state job only until he could find a job here. Now it looks like he's going to continue to fly to work Monday mornings and fly home Thursday evenings indefinitely. Boy, the job market really figures into a lot of people's plans, doesn't it, Michelle Singletary?
It sure does. It sure does. You know, I understand people do what they feel is necessary. There's a lot of time away from the family. You know, when I tell people make these kind of decisions, you need to look at the entire picture, including what's going to happen to your family life. And so if it works for them and they can afford it, you know, certainly go forward with that. You know, I'd be a little concerned about him being on the road that much flying away from the family.
We're talking with Michelle Singletary, the financial correspondent for The Washington Post and a personal finance contributor to NPR's Day to Day. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And this is Talk of the Nation coming to you from NPR News. Let's talk with Rich. Rich is with us from Savannah in Georgia.
Hi there. How you guys doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to call in and talk a little about the whole inflation thing. And I've been investing in commodities and doing quite well because I think one place you can invest in with virtual certainty right now is if you invest in things which are inflation-proof or not in the U.S. dollars. You're going to do pretty well because the U.S. is going to keep spending, printing money that it doesn't have, and as money flows into the markets, it's going to adjust and it's going to inflate. It's almost a certainty.
When you're saying commodities, what are you talking about, gold?
Gold, silver, oil, these types of things. I mean, everybody knows that gold's broken all of its records. And silver is on an upward trend.
But only now, only now. Listen, I understand what you're saying, but and obviously on your next segment, Neil, I'm sure the Miley Fool folks will talk about this. For the average person, you need to look at your plan overall and not just try to invest when times are like this, like a rush to gold. You need to have a diversified plan that, yes, invest in inflation-proof things, but also invest in things that are cyclical. You need to have some exposure to the international market, bonds, cash. You need to have a diversified portfolio. This is not the time to try to segment your investing because gold wasn't always done as well as it has now. And I think when people say things like that, it leads people to jump out of, you know, plans that have been set and are good for them to try to chase returns. And that's not what you want to do.
Well, the
Rich, I suspect you disagree, but in any case, we'll have to see how it works out.
Well, the whole system. I want to say this one thing.
Quickly, if
you will. Every fiat currency that has ever existed in history has collapsed. That's all.
All right. Thanks, Rich. And interesting, Michelle Singletary, we didn't get the calls we might have expected about collectibles or pieces of art. Is this a time for people to reconsider what to do with that? Well, we mentioned the comic book collection.
You know, listen, it's really hard to make money in this. Some people can do it really well. I mean, if that's something that you love to do and you happen to make money of it, sure. I'm not one of these people who think that this is the time to do that. I mean, you know, for the average person, you don't have the money for this and you're not going to make it. So, you know, the best way to do if you're concerned is to have a well-diversified portfolio. And some of that could include collectibles. But me, you know, I'm leaving the comic books to the comic page because it's a lot cheaper.
Let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Ashley. Ashley with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question for your guest today is, what do you do if you don't have if you don't need a plan B, but you need a plan A? I have a fine arts undergraduate degree. I work as a waitress. I have $30,000 in student loan and credit card debt. I rent, and I just can't dig myself out of my hole.
Right. Do you live near family, Ashley?
I do.
So are you living out on your own?
I do. I live by myself.
Okay, you need to go back home to mama. No, seriously, you can't do it all, right? That's what you found out.
Right.
And you've got a lot of expenses, and if you've got a good relationship with your parents or your auntie or grandma, go home and try to save on that rent and all those expenses and pay down that debt. Now, is that $30,000 just in student loan debt or student loan and credit card debt?
I have $4,000 I owe on my car, $23,000 in student loan debt, and the rest is credit cards.
So, and then I don't know where you are, if you're driving or listening, but when you ever get to a place that you can stop, I want you to reach in that wallet, and I want you to pull out all those cards, and I want you to cut them up.
Actually, they're in my freezer. I
put them in a jar.
Good. So you made that first step. So that's part of plan A, to not use any more credit and to stay away from debt. But if you can, I don't know when your lease is up, but when it's up, is it up soon?
It's up in November.
November. That's not soon enough. Can you get out of it? Can you talk to the landlord?
I would have to.
Talk to the landlord and see. You know, typically in some places, if they can find another renter, they'll let you out and you won't be charged those extra months. But if you can't, stay there till November. When that lease is up, go back home so that you can start to save some money and pay down that debt.
And Ashley, we know you don't pay for call waiting because we would have heard the click of your mother calling on your line. Thanks very much for the call, Ashley. Good luck.
Thank you.
And Michelle Singletary, thanks as always. We really appreciate your time today.
You're so welcome.
Michelle Singletary, financial correspondent for The Washington Post, personal finance contributor for NPR's Day to Day, with us by phone today from her home in Maryland. Coming up, another asset you might be thinking about liquidating is your stock portfolio. But wait, the Motley Fool arrives shortly. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.